This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To, Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you once again, and as always, you are listening to the show live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, or you're tuned in to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the program on our HRRN website at horseracingradio.net. Well, you know, so many times over the years, I've had the chance to welcome a guest who has a very unique story, and that's the case with this show here today. Today's guest has a tremendous story, and that's probably even an understatement. The 79-year-old trainer was born in Butte, Montana, and grew up just about 30 minutes southeast of there in Whitehall, Montana. He has saddled 361 career winners since turning his attention to training racehorses approximately 30 years ago. However, much of that time, he was pretty much dabbling in the sport, but since 2008, he has averaged more than 20 winners a year, and if you look up his record on Equibase, you'll see that he is listed as a graded stakes winning trainer, courtesy of his ultra-talented sprinter, Chief Cicatrices, who dominated the 2018 renewal of the Grade 3 Aristides at Churchill Downs. But all of that, as good as it is just a very small part of his amazing story. He is a three-time world champion saddle bronc rider. In 1979, he was inducted into the Pro Rodeo Hall of Fame. He spent time working on the ranch of famed oil company executive and legendary horse breeder Nelson Bunker Hunt, and he has dined with late President Ronald Reagan on the White House lawn. Yeah, I told you, it's a fantastic story. So get tied on for the next hour as I welcome trainer Sean Davis to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Sean, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for taking some time.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's kind of a humbling experience with my limited time in racehorses.
Well, let me tell you, I go through that resume, and I know that I was just trying to hit a few highlights. I know there is so much more that we're going to talk about over the next hour. But let's start in the beginning. Where did your love of horses and rodeo, I guess, initially come from? Take me back to the beginning.
Well, it started when that's the only thing I ever wanted to be was the world champion cowboy from the time I could walk. My parents, because of the attitude or the reputation of the cowboys at that time, wasn't very interested in me doing that. But I spent a lot of time with my grandparents on a little farm in Butte, Montana. And as long as I can remember, they'd let me ride goats and calves. You know, when I was 3 years old, I was riding goats and calves and they let me send me on a horse, but I didn't ride a lot until I was about 4 or 5.
Wow. You say your parents weren't really interested in you following that career path because of the reputation of cowboys at that time. What does that mean?
Well, the cowboy at that time, you know, was you know, they had kind of a drinking, carousing attitude, even though they were great athletes. And my parents kind of looked... thought that maybe I ought to be in something else. Just to kind of give you a background, when I went to school when I was 5 and to a country school, and of course it was all farm kids, and my mother dressed me in white shoes. She wanted me to be a tap dancer and dressed me in white shoes and pants and sent me to the country school, where you can imagine the first education I got. And they were busy with the ranch and didn't have much interest in my being a rodeo cowboy.
So when you finally decided that, look, I'm going to do this anyway, what was their reaction?
Well, it wasn't really positive because I used to, if they knew I was riding, they'd come and draw me out. And then actually the first time they ever seen me ride in a rodeo was when I won my first world championship at Oklahoma City. But they didn't support the fact that I wanted to be a cowboy, but my uncles and my grandparents did, and I stayed a lot with them, and then our neighbors, their boy was the same age as I was, and his dad was a saddle bronc rider, and he wanted him to be a saddle bronc rider also, and I'd get off the bus after school. Our ranches were about a mile apart, and I'd get off the bus after school, and I'd go to his house, and his dad had the cows in. I'd ride one with a bareback rig and a bull rope and a saddle, at least once a week when the weather was right. And then I'd have to walk home, but I'd always fall in the creek, so I'd have my way of explaining why my pants were all dirty.
You know, I'm picturing as you're telling me this story and you're talking about always wanting to be a cowboy and a rodeo star. I'm picturing as you're growing up and you're riding at your parents' farm, you're in a cowboy hat and jeans and dressed up the part as well. And, you know, maybe even a rope and practicing roping and things like that. Was that the young Sean Davis? Am I picturing it correctly?
Well, somewhat, because my granddad is kind of, well, both my grandparents had a lot of influence on my interest, but my granddad on my father's side, the Davis side, he actually, the story goes that he ran away from home when he was 9 years old with a man with some racehorses, and I hear them stories, and then he come to Montana, and he bought his ranches, basically, or got his start by running wild horses and selling them to the government, and all them stories he could actually ride up and rope a horse, front foot a horse on the range, and he roped that well. I never did rope calves or anything except in the pastures, and I had a rope, but it was at a young age I learned how to front foot horses, you know, because we handled horses a lot different in those times than we do now.
Why was saddle bronc the direction you wanted to go?
Well, it really wasn't the direction I wanted to go. Jim Shoulders at that time was my hero, and he was the world champion bareback bull rider and all around. And I started riding barebacks and bulls. The bulls weren't very, it wasn't as easy to find bulls in rodeos as it is now, in Montana, especially in youth rodeos. Now it's totally common and you see it all the time. And then, but Casey Tibbs, you know, he got all the publicity. It was one of the greatest influence on the sport. It kind of gets back to your question of was my parents supportive? Well, we were going to the state high school rodeo, and a friend of mine he always wanted to beat me at the things I'd done, and he was a bigger fella and didn't have the same amount of abilities, and so we thought it'd be a joke, and he was always having some kind of a wreck, so I had to forge my parents' names on all of our entries, and so when we got there to the rodeo, it was at White Sulphur Springs, Montana, and the way they chose the horses is there was a man by the name of Rankin, who was an attorney, that he owned 800 head of horses out there, and they'd run them in, and the mares would be the bareback horses, and the stallions would be the saddle broncs. Well, when we got there, they hadn't drawn yet, and I'd entered Roy in the bronc riding, but I had a bronc saddle, and I'd taken all the equipment for him. So when he seen that, he agreed to stay in if we would get in. I was lucky enough to place on the first horses I ever got on, and that's what started there. I ended up winning. I think I won third or fourth in the saddle bronc riding, and that's how I actually got into the saddle bronc riding, because I was only entered in the bareback riding and the bull riding.
for people, Sean, that might not be familiar with that discipline, talk about what saddle bronc riding actually is and what it entails.
Well, saddle bronc riding, you know, you use a buck rein, just a rope to hang on to. It's a braided rope. And then you've got an association saddle. It's a saddle that's built on a tree that everyone has to ride. And the other advance of bareback riding is you hang on to a rigging with one hand that's solid. Of course, the bulls and the bull rope, the way you stay on is with a rope, and you pull a rope. But the saddle bronc riding is more like what happened on the range, for years leading up to rodeo.
You know, you mentioned the bull riding earlier, too, and I'm curious. One of the nicest people in the sport of thoroughbred racing, one of my favorite people, is Hall of Fame trainer Carl Nafsker, who is also a member of the Professional Bull Riding Hall of Fame. Have you had much time to spend with Carl over the years at all?
A lot of time. Carl and I have been friends since the 60s. And Carl was a very good bull rider, and he chose racing over bull riding because he could see more future in it, and he made the right choice. He's played a lot of influence because another story is when we got in the racehorse business, we didn't know much about it, and other than the fact that I'd started from the time I was a little kid, but there was a lot I didn't know, and I always would talk to Carl to find out the things we needed to do. And as time went on, and we spent a lot of time. In fact, we've gone to the Kentucky Derby with Carl since Halo won the Derby. So anyhow, I've had a lot of help with Carl and the things I do in the racehorse business.
Talking with trainer Sean Davis here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. As you can hear, he is quite accomplished on the rodeo side of things, and he actually has a horse who could potentially find his way into the Breeders' Cup in a couple of weeks. That's Chief Cicatrice. We'll talk more about him as we move throughout the program. But Sean, in terms of your rodeo career, we mentioned the saddle bronc and the championships, the world championships that you earn. I talk about the Hall of Fame. Take me back to that first world championships and the moments, the days coming into it, and what that was like for you.
Well, of course, at that time, they didn't have as much money added at the National Finals Rodeo, and I had a quite successful year. It was my first year out of college, and I had a quite successful year because I believe I entered 76 rodeos, won 25, and set an all-time money winner record. So I had a substantial lead going into the National Finals Rodeo. I did have some concern, that they could overtake me, but I really had it was mainly I had control of the lead before and during the rodeo. But it was a goal that I had. It was what I'd lived for. And it was very exciting. The thing that I learned, though, after I became the world champion, that a month after you're the world champion, you better be in the lead again, or nobody hardly remembers it. So I did get a lesson that what was really big to me wasn't as big to the rest of the spectator world.
As a kid that was growing up wanting to be a rodeo world champion, to finally reach that pinnacle, what was that moment like, Sean?
Oh, it was one of the greater moments, of my life, and I still remember those things. And then the fact that I had the amount of success I had doing it the first year. I'd accomplished my goals, but it took me a month or two to realize I had to establish new goals and make new plans if I was going to go forward with. I couldn't live on what I just done.
How about the next two world championships? What were they like?
Well, they were exciting. My next goal was to win more championships than Casey Tibbs. I had a I got in the bull ride in Scottsdale the next year and tore a groin muscle in half and didn't get to participate until June. And so so I ended up fifth in my second year of rodeo. Then I come back and won two more world championships. And of course, I'm hoping for the sixth. And then on the next year, I'd won more money than any contestant had ever won in the bronc riding. At that time of the year, I was probably having the best year I'd ever had. And I had a friend that put on a ranch rodeo, but it was a professional rodeo in Thompson Falls, Montana. And he asked me if I'd come, you know, because that was my home state, and it was a big opportunity for him. And so I went there, and I got into bareback riding and the bronc riding, and I had a horse fall with me there, broke my back very seriously. They told me I wouldn't walk again. And that meant other challenges in my life, you know.
Yeah, as you're laying there in the hospital bed with that broken back and you get that kind of news, as somebody, Sean, who was so active and so accomplished in that sport, what goes through your mind when you hear those words that you may not walk again?
Well, I don't know why. I was always positive. And they come by, the nurses come by and tell me how lucky I was. I finally asked them, I said, well, I'm lucky to tell me I'm never going to walk. And they said, well, this kind of an accident. You know, there's only been five people at this time that we're aware of that's ever lived through this accident. So with that, but I never, for some reason, I always thought that I would be able to ride to the national finals that year because I'd already qualified. You know, I had enough money that I was going to qualify. That didn't happen. I was in a body cast for 6 months, and then when I come out of the body cast, you know, I could walk, I could do everything, even though my back was fused an inch out of place because of the lack of technology at that time. They couldn't move it back into place, and I was an inch shorter and an inch bigger in the waist, even though I was 15 pounds lighter. But, you know, it just meant that I have another challenge to meet.
Well, you met it. You worked your way back to the National Finals Rodeo after suffering that broken back. And that was really, as you're talking about here, Sean, that was against all odds. How were you able to get back there?
Well, I think one thing is, for some reason, I don't know why, I always thought I would. And then I was offered an opportunity to do a publicity tour. They took a rodeo to Europe, and they asked me to do a publicity tour with Miss Rodeo America and two Native Americans. And then which I took a 3 weeks around Europe meeting with the mayors of different cities and doing the publicity. And when I come back, they hired me to take charge of the Native Americans they were taking over and also be in the production of rodeo. And so I spent 6 months doing that. And doing that, I created my own, because you didn't have the therapy opportunities that you do now. And I created my own programs. And when I come back, Jim Shoulders put on a rodeo school annually. And as a favor, he asked me if I'd instruct the bronc riding there, and I told him I would. And so when I was there instructing the bronc riding, he said to me, he had a horse that was just a perfect horse to ride if you wanted to really be showy and win something. And he said, you want to get on I think his name was Colonel Blue. And I said, yeah, I'll try him. And so I got on. He made the worst bronc ride I'd ever made in my life. But I stayed on. I found out it didn't hurt. And they run him in the next day, and I rode him and rode him like he should have been ridden. And I entered the rodeo at Gladewater that weekend, and I won it, the first rodeo coming back. But the situation is I never could ride as good or the same after I had broken my back, even though I went to national finals another 7 times.
You talked about how special it was just winning that first world championship and how much that meant to you to fulfill that dream. as you walked into the arena for the first time in the National Finals Rodeo after suffering the broken back, coming back, going through everything that you just laid out, what do you remember about that moment as you were getting ready to compete that night?
At the National Finals Rodeo?
Yeah, yeah.
The good thing, you know, of course, you know, I had high expectations and the desire. The thing that I was always able to do, and I think it's important to anyone coming back off of injuries, is I always would think about the competition rather than the injury. And consequently, I was successful always coming back off an injury. And again, it was just like when I walked into the arena, it was just like the first time I'd been there. You know, can I do it? I'm just going to give it my best shot.
You know, I read a story as I was getting ready for the show, Sean, and it talked about, well, you kind of touched on it earlier in the interview where you said, you know, that your parents weren't really thrilled with you being a cowboy because of the reputation of cowboys at that time, that, you know, they could be, you know, part of the drinking crowd and, you know, cussing and all those kinds of things. That wasn't you. You were clean living, church going. You didn't drink. You didn't cuss. Some of the cowboys didn't really accept that very well. And at one point, you even had a cowboy challenge you to a fist fight, which you accepted. Tell me about that story.
Yeah. What was happening was back in the 60s in the hippie era. And, I had some friends in Denver during the stock show when they had some free time, and they go down to a bar and they take some clippers, and they actually get into some hassles with some of the hippies and shear them. And so the night or two later, they were going back, and I always just wanted to figure out what was going on. And I went to him and I said, hey, you guys, you need to stay out of this deal. I said, you'll be the ones coming back sure tonight. Why don't you forget that and let that go? Well, they figured out I was right. And then there was another cowboy come in, and he said he was disappointed because they didn't go to the bar and shear the hippies. So and so he was quite loud about it. And then he called me some names and said, all you have to do is dress up fancy and act like a woman, and you can and that's what Sean Davis is. Well, at that time I invited him outside, or actually there you just formed a ring. That hotel would just make you pay with what you broke up, and everybody come out there and you could fight. So that's what that story was.
Yeah, it didn't work out too well for him. He didn't realize that you were also a Montana State Golden Gloves boxing champion and a Montana Athlete of the Year. So you were willing to accept that challenge wherever it was going to be.
Yeah, he didn't. I think I got hit once in the fight, but it went on a long time. But he was a tough guy, and he took a good beating.
I know that you were very big into fitness. I mentioned the boxing championship and swimming and surfing, golf, skiing, whatever you could do to stay in shape. You were very physically fit as a young man, and I'm sure you still keep fit today. Where did you find time to do all of that and become a Hall of Fame rodeo member?
Well, I think that's part of becoming that, because see, at the rodeo you have a lot of free time, you know, and so we'd always, you know, depending on where we were and everything, I never was a great runner, but I run, you know. I'd sort of skip rope because I'd box. I'd sort of skip rope and punching bag or something in the box. But and then lots of times at the rodeos, when we had free time, we'd go to the gym and we'd have you know, we'd choose up teams and we'd box and we'd wrestle and different things. And then I've always had a set exercise program that I do every morning. You know, even at my age, on my 75th birthday, I could do 105 push-ups. So
wow.
So I'm still fairly fit in some ways, you know.
What do you remember about the day that you got the news that you would be inducted into the Rodeo Hall of Fame?
Well, you know, I was quite thrilled. What had happened then? They were just changing the association and everything, and for some reason, elected me as vice president when I was at a very young age, and which would have been better if I'd have stayed out of it. But anyhow, and they just built the hall and just built the association, they just built the new buildings and everything in Colorado Springs. And it was quite an honor to, you know, be chosen, because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't real old either, to be chosen to be in the original inductees.
Yeah, the induction into the Hall of Fame. Then, of course, you were the president of the National Finals Rodeo, very instrumental in moving that event out to Las Vegas for the first time. Take me back to that time in your life. What was happening there?
Well, what had happened there was we were in Oklahoma City, and well, actually, I was always thought I was just a teenager when the rodeo started in Dallas. And, you know, the original one, when they had President Eisenhower and everything. But I was always interested in promoting the sport, even as a teenager, and I don't know why. And so I followed it, but I didn't attend it till 1963 was the first year I qualified for the National Final Rodeo. But the what happened, I was president of the organization, and I got a call. And my secretary, I was actually at the racetrack galloping a horse, and my secretary sent someone to find me. Brought me a message to call Harry Wald at Caesar's Palace that he wanted to talk to me about the National Finals Rodeo. And so, you know, there was no cell phones or anything at that time, so I called him from a payphone and at the racetrack, and he asked me if I would be interested in considering a proposal to move the National Finals Rodeo to Las Vegas. And I said, well, yeah, we'd always like an opportunity to, but, you know, Oklahoma City has done us a wonderful job up to this point, and it would take a considerable amount of more money than we're getting to get us to consider the move. And he said, well, could you meet with me and we'll discuss it. And Benny Binion, who was owned the Horseshoe in Las Vegas and very influential in that city, was a friend of mine for years. And so I called Benny and I said, what do you know about Harry Wall? He's offered me a proposal to move the rodeo to Las Vegas. And he said, well, he's a good guy and he's a pretty square shooter. And I said, well, Benny, would you... let's set up a meeting. Would you be willing to attend it with me? Because I was pretty, you know, pretty green negotiations on something like that. And that's how it got off the ground. And then we spent a couple of years discussing it. And then we actually, to be fair to Oklahoma City, I set up a meeting after the 1964, I think it was, where they would both, cities would come to Colorado Springs make their proposals, and at that time we wouldn't let any phones or anybody in or out of the room, and we'd let them make a proposal, and then we'd take a straw vote, and then so everybody knew exactly what they were voting on, we would come back, let each committee answer all the questions and add anything or subtract anything they could. And and the first vote was in favor of Oklahoma City, and then when they come back in Las Vegas, up their ante another 90,000, and that basically tripled everything that we were getting in Oklahoma City. But Oklahoma City had come up to the difference of 90,000 in the final proposal. Oklahoma City was basing theirs on a mill levy that had never been passed, and Las Vegas actually had the money. And so it went around the table, and they would come to a tied vote. They said, basically, Mr. President, what's your decision? And my decision was to move to Las Vegas.
Well, Life magazine once described Sean Davis as a saddle bronc rider with a Tarzan build and an extraordinary talent for spurring a horse to a good ride while hanging on with apparent ease. And if you can't tell from the first half of the show, that is exactly spot on. When I come back, we're going to continue this visit with Pro Rodeo Hall of Famer Sean Davis. We'll talk to him about his love of horse racing, where that began. That's all coming up in the second half of the show, right here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.
Mid-Atlantic Foal Yearlings. Over 550 cataloged with over 150 New York breds. Ranked among the top yearling sales in North America by Grade 1 and Graded Stakes winners sold. Recent grads include Captain Scotty, Field Pass, Project Whiskey, and Pumpkin Rumble. The Fasic Tipton Mid-Atlantic Foal Yearling Sale, Monday and Tuesday, October 5th and 6th, after the Preakness in Timonium, Maryland. Where will you be?
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Smart Spree tried to cut the corner, but Chief Cicatriz on the outside has grabbed the lead and takes off with 3/16 to go, suddenly clear by four. Mr. Crow's on the wrong lead, trying to rally Wobo down toward the inside, but they're all chasing Chief Cicatriz by the 16th pole with a six-length lead, and this one will ramble home much the best in the Aristides. Chief Cicatriz by five in the end. Mr. Crow was second. Wobo was third. Awesome Saturday finished fourth.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch. That was Travis Stone with the call of Chief Cicatriz, otherwise known as Chief Scar. Cicatriz, the Spanish word for scar, getting a huge win in the Aristides at Churchill Downs back in 2018. And there's a chance we could see Chief Cicatriz in this year's Breeders' Cup Sprint, but a lot of things have to fall in place between now and then to make that happen. But what a moment it would be for my special guest on Trainer Talk today. That is trainer Sean Davis. Chief Cicatriz, actually named for one of the main characters in the 1956 Western film The Searchers that was played by the late Harry Brandon. And yeah, it would be special if he could get to the Breeders' Cup for Sean Davis. He's been knocking on the door a couple of times, hasn't quite gotten there. But Sean, that moment in 2018 when he won at Churchill Downs and dominated the field had to be so, so special for you.
Well, that was probably my highlight of all horse racing in my horse racing career. And as exciting as I have ever been, even winning world championships.
No kidding. You would compare it and say it was pretty much the same thrill.
You know what? That's kind of what the horse racing does. Is it fills in the you've got the challenge of the win, and the challenge of the preparation through the horse rather than doing it yourself. And to be somewhere I'd only hope to be, and to win a race at Churchill Downs of that caliber was very, very exciting to me.
We'll spend some time talking about how you started to fall in love with thoroughbred racehorses here in a minute, but I want to stick with Chief Cicatriz for a minute. I mentioned that his name translates to Chief Scar, and you told me when I called you to ask you to join me on the program that he does actually have a scar on his face.
Yeah, he has a scar on his right shoulder.
Oh, his right shoulder, okay.
Yeah, it's the size of your hand, and he's always had that since I've had him. As a baby, he got cut.
Oh, wow. What do you remember about the first time that you saw Chief Cicatriz?
Well, Chief Cicatriz, the first time I saw him, he was a really nice yearling, but on a very, very well balanced. But he wasn't, he was just a normal size, or maybe, a hair on the small side. But he was a well balanced horse.
When did you know that he could really run?
Well, when I actually had horses at Denver at that time, and I had three or four 2-year olds that I was training, and I thought that when we started working them and training them together, he seemed to handle them horses very easily. So I started setting him when I'd work him, I'd set him quite a ways behind him, and then at the wire, let him pick up, and I'd always work him a 16th of a mile or a quarter of a mile past the wire. And the further we went, I'd put him 10 lanes behind, and they'd move up right before the wire, and then they'd run around that corner, and he'd put 10 lanes on him going around that corner. I knew that, that he was somewhat special at that time.
Yeah, he's taken you to places such as Churchill Downs, as I mentioned, and he's taken you out west to Del Mar. He's taken you all throughout the Southwest with Turf Paradise and Sunland and Zia, Canterbury up in Minnesota, Remington Park, of course, where he won his most recent race on September 27th. When you think about Chief Cicatrice and 7-year-old gelding, what is it about him? How has Sean Davis been able to keep him going at a high level for so long?
Well, I think the owner is an important part of that, because I've always been very careful with my horses, and especially with him, of not running them when they had an opportunity of, which is of having problems, And he's Chief Cicatrice as a 2-year-old. We run him. He run a big race. We were offered more money than I'd ever been offered from a horse before the picture was over. But when he come back, I took him. I was going to stretch him out, and he didn't train well, and we had him x-rayed, and he had spurs on his knees, so we had them taken off. And then it was a year before we run him again, so it's been that. Roy Gene Evans, who is the owner and breeder of the horse, has always been very patient and just wanted the best out of the horse. And I think that's what the success to keeping him running this long and in this kind of company has been.
Didn't you tell me, too, that some of his siblings or half-siblings share similar names to Cicatrice?
Oh, yeah. His half-sister is Popzanna. Which Roy Gene is a big Native American, especially Apache or in Comanche. He does a lot of research about that, and he's into Western, a lot of Western things, and he called his half brothers Hondo Lane.
How did that relationship come about with you and owner Roy Gene Evans?
Well, we put on what we call rodeo tours back in the, it's been about 15 years ago. And Roy Gene is in the banking business, but his family's always had quarter horses. And he's a brilliant man, but he loves the things he does. And anyhow... they put on the for the children's hospital there. They put on things like the Byron Nelson golf tournament and that. He's big on those. And then we took a rodeo to Dallas of what we called a tour rodeo. There was a series of them that we had a finals, and I produced that rodeo, and Roy Gene was on that committee. And in doing so, we got to be good friends. And then he sent me a couple horses before he sent Chief Cicatrice that I had some success with, and they were good horses. But anyhow, that's how we got acquainted through the production of that rodeo.
You talked about the similarities that winning the Aristides provided, similar to winning a world championships on the rodeo side of things, and that thrill that you get when your horse wins a big race. Sean, do you even allow yourself to think about what the moment could be like if Chief Cicatrice were to pull off a win in a race like the Breeders' Cup Sprint?
Well, I probably, even though it was my goal, I'd probably be more excited about something like that than I would even, it'd be something more than I could even hope for.
When did you first know that you might want to get involved with racehorses?
I always wanted my grandfather both grandfathers had something to do with racehorses. The one, my grandfather on my mother's side is Irish and come from Ireland. And had some association with some racing, but my grandfather on my father's side, he, like I said, run away from home when he's 9 years old with racehorses from Illinois and come to Montana, fell totally out of the business but told the stories. And he'd get me as a little kid to come over, and he'd tell me stories in the evening. We didn't have – you had a radio, but you didn't have TV at that time, and I listened to all those stories. And so I was always enthused about racing. And then first time I – and we'd race our horses when we were little kids, when we were young kids, you know, 6, 7 years old, we'd race our horses on the gravel road, you know. And then at that little town I was, they had a half-mile track, and then some of them, my uncles and different people would get at the bars and get to betting whose saddle horse was the best and run races, match races and different things. And so that's kind of where I got my interest. And then as I was growing up, I wasn't very old then, 8 or 9, and my uncle a friend of his who run the stockyards there bought a thoroughbred mare for $15 that come through that had papers on her, and they took her to Arlee, Montana, bred her to a horse called Flying Scott, who run I think third or fourth in the Kentucky Derby, and they sent that mare to Phoenix and raced her. In the meantime, I was always small, and they told me I was going to be a jockey if I couldn't be a rodeo cowboy. So when she never had much success, but when they brought her back, they were trying to run this mare long, but she was very fast. And the first experience, so they brought her to me and told me, and I saved all my money to get a pair of racing reins. Well, I didn't have a saddle, so I didn't need any rubber to stop her because I couldn't stop her anyhow. And I'd take her out there in the field every night, or at least 3 or 4 times a week. And you go about a quarter of a mile, and you had to jump a ditch, and then you go another quarter of a mile, and you could make a circle. The field was big enough, you could make a circle and get her to slow down. And so I'd work her 2 or 3 times a night for several weeks, and they had a kind of a gymkhana deal where they had horse racing and different things, and I talked my dad into taking me up there to the horse races, and at that time you didn't have very few trailers. You either jumped your horse into the back of the pickup, or you had a 2-ton truck, and then they had ramps where you would unload them, and sometimes they were just dirt banks, you know. And so anyhow, there was a little white mare that our neighbors had that nothing could outrun in that country. I mean, she was just much better than anything. Well, when we went to the race, now the mare that I had, because I've worked her plenty, looked like she was a racehorse, and she looked like a racehorse. Well, I'd heard the stories about Lap and Tap, and I was still bareback, and and the starter was the guy that owned the white mare. Well, when we started going to the line to break us off, he called us back. And when I turned around and they started the race, and I was faced backwards. But I caught the field at the quarter pole, and I mean, she was running a third faster than anything that they had, or maybe more than that. And I went by them, and that little white mare was 10 ahead of them. And I caught her at the 16 pole and probably put 5 or 6 on her before I hit the wire. Well, at the wire, the track was only had a rail on the inside, and it had an unloading ramp on that corner for those trucks. Well, she's running so fast she couldn't make that half mile corner, and she ran out on that bank. And of course, it was above there was a pickup parked there, but it was below that. I jumped off that bank over that pickup, and she ran down and turned into the first stall. So that was my first race ride.
And yet, you still wanted to be a guy that would climb aboard bucking broncos for a living.
I don't know if it's any more exciting than that. Anyhow.
Yeah, unbelievable! What a thrill! What a great story. Sean Davis, by the way, my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Again, Chief Cicatrice, who we just talked about, a horse that you may see in the Breeders' Cup in a couple of weeks if things go right over the course of that time frame. Sean, is it true that we may have never heard of Hall of Fame jockey Gary Stevens had it not been for a horse by the name of Fancy Avenger?
Oh, well, I don't know if you'd always heard of Gary Stevens, but that was my first racehorse when we actually lived in Texas, and my wife and I had we'd gotten the cattle business for a hobby. I actually made a living rodeo, but we got in the cattle business for a hobby, me and a friend of mine, and it was the most expensive hobby. Racehorses didn't even compare to it. But there was a boy there that come, and he had a racehorse background, and he galloped a lot of horses and helped train some, and he would work for me if I teach him how to ride Bronx. And my wife, she'd taken up riding jumping horses, and we got into, and Bunger Hunt's ranch manager went to our church, and he couldn't get anybody to help him with breaking the yearlings, you know, the two-year-olds. And so my wife and Garth volunteered to go over to and help him, and which they did, and helped him break those two-year-olds. Well, what happened in the meantime, and that's where the story leading up to Fancy Avenger, her aunt and uncle had racehorses, and they were getting out of the business. They give her a mare. We bred it to a horse called Staunch Avenger. And then I was offered a job at the College of Southern Idaho as head of the rodeo program and the head of the equine program, and we accepted that job. And that filly was born in our backyards in Idaho. And in her first race, I was rodeoing, but I flew back to see her first race. And the trainer was really high on her and everything, and I flew in there just time to get to the race, and the gates opened, popped, and she bogged her head and bucked the rider off. and then the next race, Gary rode her, and that was the first win that we'd ever had, Gary Stevens on Fancy Avenger.
Yeah, what a great story. And Gary Stevens, at that point, we know him now as Hall of Fame jockey Gary Stevens, but he was still an apprentice rider at Les Bois Park at that point, wasn't he?
Well, I don't know if he was an apprentice or not for sure, but he was, you know, he was very young at that time.
Yeah.
So whether it was his apprentice year or not, I'm not sure, but I do know he was very young at that time. You know, he and Scott both were still a boy, and, you know, and their dad was training there.
You mentioned spending time on the Bunker Hunt Ranch. Did you get a chance to spend a lot of time with Nelson Bunker Hunt?
No, I met Nelson Bunker Hunt and done a deal one time with some, when they had them exotic cattle. You know, I'd done some publicity in that for them. But mainly, you know, my wife and the boy that worked for me had spent most of that time, even though we were very good friends with the ranch manager. I didn't spend that much time with Bunker himself.
Well, talking with Sean Davis here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Sean, you talked in the first half of the show. You mentioned your first experience in attending the Kentucky Derby, which was in 1983 with Sonny's Halo when he got the victory that year. What do you remember about that experience and being part of that Derby atmosphere?
Well, it was a great experience, and I tell you how that come about is, you mentioned earlier, Malcolm Ballridge, who was the Secretary of Interior, was a rodeo cowboy, and he team roped. And when Ronald Reagan became president, they were great friends. And after the election, he come to me and he said, what do you think? I was president at that time of the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association. And he said, what do you think about putting on a rodeo in Landover, Maryland for the president? And I said, well, you know, we'd love to, you know, let me check with the board of directors. And then we had a guy by the name of Ken Sibler and Bob Edson who were basically in charge and great. They had great foresight. So anyhow, we put on a rodeo for at the Landover, Maryland. We sent out 8,500 invitations, and then they come back and asked if we had 1,200 seats. And actually, they asked for more invitations. We filled it up, and after the rodeo, we had our awards presentation. We had a dance with Red Steagall and also dinner with the president on the White House lawn and Malcolm Baldrige. And that's so at that point we had invited guests, and Marriott was one of the guests that we invited to attend that because we were courting them for sponsorship. Well, in return, they invited me to the Kentucky Derby as their guest, and that's what that's was my first Derby, and Sonny Halo was the one that won it. And I do remember there's been quite a change. The only thing in the infield at that time was Man of War, and also and Johnny Jimmy Carter was the president, and they had a race to honor Jimmy Carter, and I remember the purse structure was $5,000, so there's been a lot of changes to the Kentucky Derby in that time.
Yeah, I would certainly say so. You know, you talked, I started the show, Sean, by telling people that your story was a tremendous story, and I know that we've gotten into a lot of it, and there's probably still plenty more that we could tell, and we will try to get to before we wrap things up in the next little bit, but could you ever imagine, as a kid growing up in a small town in Montana, that one day you'd be sitting there having dinner with the president on the White House lawn?
And I couldn't. It's beyond my imagination that I'd have them kind of opportunities.
Yeah, what was that night like? Take me back there with you. Was it just surreal and you know, kind of one of those nights where you're pinching yourself?
I actually rode in the rodeo too. But situation is that there was a lot of responsibility there because of the security, making sure everything was focusing, making sure we held up our part of the bargain. But, you know, to be with the president and getting to sit and visit with the president and Malcolm Baldrige and those people was, you know, I never thought that I'd ever have those kind of opportunities. But also I had some pressure, too, that I was concerned that I was holding up my end of the bargain.
You know, you talked about some of the rodeo cowboys that you would look up to, and you wanted to break those records as you were getting started with your rodeo career. Have there been, now that you've been on the thoroughbred side for a little bit here, have there been other trainers? I know we mentioned Carl Nasker, who's a good friend, but have there been other trainers that you have taken time to reach out to or been around and pick their brain a little bit as you've gone through this process of training racehorses over the years?
Yes, sir, have. And one thing that I always learned from the time I was a kid in the rodeo business or whatever I did, you needed to watch and try to communicate with the people who were successful and watch to see why they were successful and find out as much information as you can. And even though racing was my hobby, I've had great opportunities with Dwayne Lucas, Bill Mott, several of the leading trainers that, you know, I'd have as guests at the National Finals Rodeo. They appreciated the rodeo business. And doing so, I got to communicate, you know, people like Bill Kasner, one time Windstar, and those people have all been my guests. And I actually done some features of horses like Cigar and these people as a special event at the National Finals Rodeo.
Are there things, Sean, that you take away from spending all those years riding Bronx to now training racehorses? Are there things you've taken away from that side or from that particular sport that you're incorporating today that have kind of helped you in working with thoroughbreds?
A lot of things, because things that I've learned because I've coached, I've done a lot of things, but fundamentals is the important thing and being practical. And the other thing is, you have to be good in any sport, you have to be you got to criticize yourself and learn and be honest with yourself. And I think that's very important in the horse racing business is to keep to the fundamentals. And then be honest with yourself. Just because you own the horse, you know, you got to put him where he can win.
Sean, of all the things that you've accomplished in your life, in your career, what are a couple of the things that you're most proud of?
Well, I think our world championships is the most proud of. I think the fact that I've been as successful as I have, especially secretaries, would be one of the proudest things I've done. And of course, my son is very successful, and he's the Rain cow horse. And the fact that he got a lot of, ways of conducting himself from what we learned in rodeo.
Yeah, that's a very special thing, and I'm sure that there are many great things ahead for your son, as there are for you, Sean. We're down to about the final 3 minutes or so. I always like to end the show by asking trainers to let us know a little something about themselves that we haven't already talked about. So maybe some other hobbies or interests that you have outside of the horses. Are there a couple of things that you enjoy doing when you get away from the horses?
Well, of course, I always enjoyed a lot of sports. And we enjoy going back in those memories and friends and people that and at this point in my life, that's kind of going to be the things that I concentrate on now, other than the horses, is doing things that and remembering friends and associations.
Do you get much time away from the horses, Sean? Because I know I always talk about training horses being a 365-day-a-year, 24-hour-a-day type of job. Do you get much time away?
Not a lot, but I've learned this, that you've got to have good people in whatever you do. And lately I've had really good people, so it gives me them freedoms to choose when I need to be there and when I don't need to be there. And so that frees me up. And then one thing about my kind of training, because mainly it's a hobby, I can just cut down the numbers and that helps me free myself up so I can live my life on kind of on a normal basis.
How many horses do you have in your barn now, Sean?
Well, it's cut way down. The most I've had this summer is 24. And then right here at Remington, I've only got 7, but I've sent some to Rosia Park. And because of the pandemic and everything, we've never replaced everything. And we're kind of in a mode now that's kind of see and wait mode.
Well, Sean, I can tell you it's been a delight to hear your story and to kind of go down memory lane with you. And congratulations on everything that you've accomplished. All the best moving forward, not just with Chief Cicatrice, although it would be wonderful to see him in the Breeders' Cup. I hope it happens. If not, I know there's brighter moments ahead with him and your other horses, too. So keep up the wonderful work and keep representing the sport the way you have. Really appreciate the visit here today.
And thank you for having me on, Mike. And I just appreciate being able to be associated with such a wonderful sport.
Sean, appreciate the visit and continued success, my friend.
Thank you.
All right, Sean Davis here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. What a story. I told you at the beginning it was tremendous. Gross understatement. Fantastic life that Sean Davis has led, and it continues at the age of 79. If you missed any portion of the show, head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast there at your leisure. You can also do it on Apple Podcasts. For my producer, Lee Delapina, for my special guest, Sean Davis, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.